Good evening, Dave.
How you? Y'all right? Y'all right? Yeah, still
brilliant, mate. It's wonderful. Dave, I am so happy to be talking to you tonight. I'm tired, I'm worn out, but this podcast and the thought of what we're going to discuss tonight has reinvigorated me. From my toes up, I'm fresh, I'm alive, I'm a new man.
You look great. It doesn't even look like you've had a recent chemotherapy session or anything. You look really good.
Thanks, Dave. It's for eyebrow pencil.
Yeah, it looks nice. Hey, we brought someone in special just for the topic that you're so excited about. There's only two guys I know in the world that can understand England in the same way that I can. You're one of them, and the other one is Dan Jenajon. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Dan, we are so excited to finally have you on. Thanks for flying all the way in from the Gold Coast for us, from the Silicon Valley, from Pacifica.
No problem.
Pacifica, California. How are the sunsets there, Dan? Is it beautiful?
Beautiful, man. Yeah, it's awesome. It can actually get really foggy here, but so we don't get them all the time. But it's funny actually when it gets foggy here. First thing that I thought when I moved here was that it reminds me a lot of England. Actually, it's kind of foggy, rains all the time. It's pretty awesome.
That's why I could never live in the Pacific Northwest. Like, honestly, it's my 2 years in England have prevented me from ever going there again.
Have you ever been there?
To the Pacific? Yeah, I've been in the Pacific Northwest. I did an interview with this for a job on like the Oregon coast, and it looked really pretty. And they said, like, yeah, it rains, you know, 70% of the days there's rain, and I couldn't do it.
You're a desert man. You tried to get as far away from England as possible for the rest of your life, huh?
Yeah, I want sunny days 360 days a year. It can rain 5 days. That's it.
Wow. See, I love the Pacific Northwest. I just came back from Vancouver this last week, guys. It was fantastic.
Oh, nice.
I could never afford it, but I'd live there.
Yeah. And I've heard Vancouver's awesome. What were you doing there?
I was at an education conference and had a great time. Then my sister lives about an hour north of Seattle, so I drove down and spent a couple of days with her and her partner.
Nice.
So at the conference, was there a class that was just entitled, "We Can Never Afford It, But It's Beautiful Here"?
Yeah, it was actually – it was a full-day seminar. A bunch of business gurus talking about student debt. All right. I wanted to start us off, since we all understand England, there's a lot to cover today. We've got some England stories. We're going to talk about our experiences proselyting for the Lord's Church in the wonderful country that is England. We're going to talk about our guest, Dan, have expert testimony, ask him about weightlifting, Wisconsin, the future of energy, about banking, about punching people in the head, and about the Middle East, all the things he really loves. And then, as always, we've got some Unchained Melodies and some book wisdom. But I thought I'd get started with just rapid-fire questions. These might bring back some memories, but just throw out your answer as quick as you can. These might ring some bells, but if someone were to say, "Oi, are you Stu's virgins?"
it just makes me so angry.
Boys, I use two tossers.
I use tossers. I use two gay.
The one that they used to ask us all the time, they would go, "Oi, Bibles, I use Jovos." I was going to say we're Jehovah's Witnesses. Man, it was the best. So we would get harassed probably, yeah, on a daily basis by street kids on council estates. They were just ubiquitous. And I know... Yeah. I don't think, Dan, you ever had any run-ins, so we just had to describe them to you. But did you ever come close to meeting any street kids when you were in England on your mission?
did I ever come close? I was just – when you were talking just now, I was thinking about Chelmsley Wood, the second area of my mission, and how it really was. It was like running with street kids every day. And I was thinking about this one day. I was there for like 6 months. I was thinking about this one day where I ran into this pack of kids. And one of them comes up to me, he's talking to me. And in the process of talking to me, he tries lighting my tie on fire. And it's one of those things where you're like, you want to be the nice guy, you know, and I kind of like play it off, play it cool, you know, like, oh, funny. But like, you know, really, like you just want to smack him 6 ways from Sunday, right? But you don't, and you just move on with life, I guess.
Was that the closest you ever came to physical violence, Dan, against a street kid?
I don't know. I mean, I never came that close to physical violence against. I think I came close to physical violence against me. I had the pleasure of being mugged at knife point in England.
Well, where was that?
Wellingboro, first area.
First area.
Yeah.
Was it on your preparation day, or were you dressed full on in your suit out doing your day's work?
No, dressed full on in the suit out doing the day's work. I want to say it was around 8 o'clock at night, walking really close to our flat, and you know, it's just like three kids walking towards us, and you know, you don't think anything of that. See kids all the time, and I was like walking with my head down, and as they went to pass us. One of them put their hand on my shoulder. So I look up and now I see this face with a bandana over it. And he says, "Give me your effing wallet." Right. And I look down and I see the knife there. And it was crazy because it's like, it's probably the most adrenaline I felt in my life.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Pretty awesome.
Because when stuff like that happens on your mission, you're a young man, like, you know that you could probably take this guy with a knife. Like, if it got down to it, like, you could take him. But you're also on a mission representing your church. So you just have to be like, you just have to be cool and like, here's the money in my wallet. Thank you for robbing me.
Yeah. I think, and then basically. You turn to your companion, you're like, I think you really felt the spirit there when I gave him my wallet.
but just so the listeners know, so that it on the mission in England, that's actually where I met Dan. We went to the training center in Preston, England, and I met Dan there. And then Dan was good friends with one of Steele's friends. And so that's, we ended up being all buddies because of the missions. And Steele, you served in a different mission, but it was just north of ours, right?
Northeast. We were in the Birmingham one. You guys were in the northwest. The one that was just north of you would have been Manchester, I think. And then I was east of Manchester. So I was in the Leeds mission.
Okay.
We went up to the Scottish border and then down to like South Yorkshire.
But the street kids, I'm just thinking my prototypical English street kid, he's wearing a Kappa tracksuit.
Yes. or LS as well. They had some LS ones.
Mm-hmm. With maybe like a white wife beater underneath. They haven't been washed for some time. There's some stains.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's like gravy stains.
It is gravy.
Baseball cap pulled like way back on the head. So like the bills sticking almost like straight up.
It's like Burberry. They wore a lot of Burberry caps as well. Did you guys have the Burberry in the West?
That might have been too classy for us. We liked a lot of Kappa. I don't know.
And the thing they used to do, they used to call them chavs in the Northeast. Is that what the nickname was for these guys?
CHAV. I've heard it since. I never heard that when I was there.
No.
Fashion hadn't spread to Birmingham yet, huh?
I guess not.
But these guys in the Northwest or Northeast, I don't think they were just going commando, and they would always have their hands down their pants playing with themselves. Was this how it was with you guys as well? Like, they'd be leaning against the wall just like going at it, like pocket pool vigorously, just like fondling themselves as they would talk to you. It was so disconcerting.
I never got that. I never had that.
Jeez. I wouldn't stop and talk to these kids. And that's the prototypical one, but they were always in like a pack of like, I don't know, 5 to 10. It was, you never just like ran into one.
No.
There was always just a load of these kids, and and they wanted to ask if you were a virgin or not. That was my number one question.
Very curious about your sexual experiences. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I remember actually was, this is probably related, but burnt out cars, like everywhere on Council Estate. I put a photo here of us in Grimsby, which is a great English town name, huh? We were in Grimsby, and we're just tracting a street, and this one looked particularly awesome because the hood had been popped up and the whole car had been burned down and had been left there for a couple of weeks. But I forgot how ubiquitous, like how common a sight. I have not seen a burnt out car just on the street anywhere I've lived in the United States, but I probably saw one every week, every other week for a good stretch of my mission.
I feel like anyone that served a mission there has a picture like this of like you're standing by the burnout car, like miming like it's yours. It just, they were just there. People burned cars and destroyed them on the street and no one took care of it. It was awesome.
Yeah.
I remember Jordan went on his backpacking trip of England. So that's where he and Rose met, actually. I remember when people would go on trips to England and they'd come back and they'd be talking about how awesome England is. Especially a little furiousness.
So you were saying, Dan, when Jordan or other people would talk about going to England and how great of a time they had, you would feel a wave of fury course through you?
Basically, yeah.
What was the origin of the fury? Why did you feel so upset that they had a good time there?
No, it's not that they had a good time there. I mean, you know, like go to England and have a great time. That's actually one of like my life goals, just to see what everybody else is talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe it is good.
Wait, it's just a sheer lack of understanding. Like someone's like, "Yeah, I really enjoyed my 2-week trip to England." I'm like, "Yeah, I don't understand what that would be like. All I know is I lived in Skegness for 6 months and it made me like re-examine like what was I doing with my life? It was a terrible, terrible place."
And I think we have to contextualize it as well, because there are people that could go to Skegness and probably have a better time than the time that you had for 6 months, primarily because of what we did with our day every day. And I think the primary thing that a missionary does is you wake up in the morning, you eat your porridge or your boring breakfast, and then you read the Bible or the Book of Mormon with your companion for a couple hours, and then you leave your house at 9:30 in the morning and you try to find people to talk to about God and Jesus Christ until 9:30 at night. Most of the time, the people that you stopped or the people whose doors you knocked on had less than zero interest in speaking with you. But this is what we call tracting. If you had to describe tracting to an alien or to someone who is totally unfamiliar with Mormons, how would you describe the experience of tracting in England?
So you go door to door. The people live in these homes, and you go up. This is their refuge from the outside world. And you go and you knock on their door, and you ask them if they would like to talk to you about Jesus Christ. And I love Jesus Christ. I love the Book of Mormon. I think they're very valid things to talk about. But I kind of understand the perspective of someone that answers the door and doesn't necessarily want to get into a conversation with you right then. Anyone that knocks on my door, I don't want to talk to anyone that knocks on my door, especially two strangers from a different country that have a message that's supposed to change my life.
You mean you wouldn't just take an hour unplanned out of your day to invite them in and talk to them about some really heavy ideas?
No, the only people that would do that, there was occasionally someone that was sincerely like wanted to learn about Jesus. But on a whole, the only people that wanted to do that were out of their minds or just really, really lonely. Yeah. One of those two.
Do you ever get the people who are, I mean, I think tracting is like, I mean, like 90% just super hard. I mean, for reasons that you guys just described, but you get these interesting experiences, you know, and not always, you know, I don't necessarily mean interesting in the ways that a Mormon missionary would hope for. And there's this amazing consistency to them too. Did you guys ever get people who would they would open the door and almost like before you could even like complete the sort of, you know, sentence about what you were there to do, they would just invite you in, and then they would basically start like crying because they're going through some really heavy stuff.
Yes.
And then once they're done, it would basically be like, okay, thank you. You know, you can go now, which I mean, it's a funny thing that happens to you. Right. But at the same time, it's one of those things where like that's a unique experience that most people don't have.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's insane that, like, I used to think that, you know, missionaries and maybe healthcare providers learn way more about people than they should. But no, even as a healthcare provider, people don't tell me the sort of stuff that they would just tell me on their doorstep or when they invited me. Like, you would suddenly learn all of the worst things that ever happened to this person. Yeah. And yeah, I guess it's good that they just had a release that day.
And yeah. The crazy thing is, we are 19 to 21 years old. We know nothing. We have received no training in dealing with emotional disturbances, relationship counseling, none of that stuff. So here we are, 20-year-old virgins, and like some divorced mother of three is like really talking about like deep-seated abuse and neglect. And you're like, I have a scripture I'd like to share with you. Like, what? I mean, talk about being totally inadequate to understanding the situation or like what like a healthy, appropriate response would be. It felt pretty beyond my capacities in a lot of those situations.
But I think the thing in most of those situations is mostly we were just stunned to silence.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't know what on earth to say to that person. And in most situations like that, that is the appropriate response.
To listen.
Just to listen and nod your head. And as a 20-year-old dressed in a suit and tie, like, you're the most polite young man this person's going to meet. And you just nod your head. And there's probably a real benefit to that.
Oh, for sure. Because you're not going to tell anybody. You're not going to humiliate them. You're not going to embarrass them. You're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
You're not going to use that power or that knowledge against them in any way. I think that is a good point, Dave. Yeah.
But did anybody ever sick their dogs on you guys?
I never had that. No.
People threatened to. I don't remember having to run from a dog.
The one time I had to run from a dog, like, you know, most of these homes, there's a front gate you have to open.
Yes.
And then you close the gate, you go and you knock on the door. And I still remember this time in Skegness, it was this huge German Shepherd just kind of came bounding out the house. And I just ran and I slammed the gate shut and my companion was still in there.
And you never saw him again.
Wait. Why'd you do that, Dave?
I don't know. I just had to get out of there, man.
The thing that I remember about tracting is you would pick a couple of areas or streets the night before that you think you would go to if you didn't have any plans or everything fell through. And I remember at one point I had a mission companion. This was very early in my mission. And he's like, okay, now that we come to the street that we're going to track, we really need to start by praying. And not just by like praying to yourself or like praying with your eyes open discreetly. He was like, all right, we kneel down on the street and we pray aloud before knocking the street. And looking back, it's hard for me to think of anything less well-suited to acceptance on a council estate in England than two dudes in suits kneeling in the street and praying before knocking on everyone on the street's doors. It's so hard for me to get back into that mindset where I was like, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's just do this.
Yeah. I think it's funny that reminds me of when I was training on the mission, which I don't know how many non-LDS people listen to this podcast, but
a handful.
But okay, so that's basically when, you know, because you're paired up with one other missionary always, and that's when the other missionary that you're paired up with is brand new and usually fairly like zealous, right? And
yeah.
So. The guy that I was training says to us one day, we're out tracting, and he's like, I think at the next door we should sing, I'm a child of God.
Just when they and, open it, like a Christmas carol?
Basically. I just said, no, we're not going to do that. And but the thing is, at the time. And now, like, I mean, I would like to think of myself as, you know, a quote unquote good missionary. I was, you know, working hard, trying to do what was right. But I guess the point is that even, and maybe it wasn't the right thing. Maybe I should have been in that mindset, but even at that time I was,
no, that's a bridge too, like, far.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because it's an idea that occurs to someone and it seems devout doesn't mean it's a good idea.
But so guys, occasionally you'd get into one of these doors and I'm just thinking of the scariest places I've ever been in my life. Yes. And I'd say most of them are in someone's home on my mission.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Some of the unhealthiest places, certainly, that I've ever been. the dirtiest, most addiction ridden, most dangerous places. Yes. Would probably be trying to teach someone on my mission.
I remember we got into this person's house and he was a large black man. And through the course of our conversation with him, it became very obvious that this man was seriously mentally ill. And we were discussing religion with him. And it just, like, yeah, 20 minutes into it, I think I started thinking, like, this guy, he could do anything that he wants to me. He's gigantic. And this guy is, could go unhinged at any moment. And I was literally afraid as we were talking to this man.
I think that was probably it's too common experience.
No, I was just going to ask what happened though.
He's the branch president now.
we finished the message. I think I hurried it up and then we just got out of there and I felt like we should never go back and we never did. I think sometimes, even if you're not religious, you can get a feeling that, like, you need to get out of here. And I think that was right. That guy, I don't know.
I have a comparable but very different story. There was a guy we used to go visit my first area of my mission when I was being trained. There was probably like 8 people that missionaries had regular contact with. And the thing that stunned me is that I was new to the mission, but it seemed to me like every single one of them had severe mental disability and would not have been considered like fully responsible for their choices or their actions. But my companion seemed to think like, this is great. This is just who we're teaching. This is normal. We're going to progress to baptism with everybody. And I just felt so deeply uncomfortable with the direction all of the conversations were going. And I was like, is this just what England is? Are English people just different from Americans in some way? And when we got to my second area, we met this really gregarious, really nice guy. And I've got a picture of him up on the blog, Trevor. You see that second guy there? We'd go to this house. He was like a house painter. And he'd have us in and talk to us and talk to us and talk to us. Always laughing, always having a great time. Always just chilling out in his underwear.
Of course. Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Just in his boxers. Sometimes he'd have a beer cracked open and he'd be talking to us. And then we thought things were going really well. We'd built up a good friendship. And then one day he's there and he's like, all of a sudden he gets really nervous because this woman's banging on the door and he lets her in and her name is Julie. And it's his heroin addicted ex-girlfriend who basically ran the place, kicked us all out. And then, things went, I don't know. I can't tell the whole story, but it went really downhill from there. And he was always talking about how scared he was of his Julie.
It seemed like that happened too often. Yeah. But I don't know. You still have to look back and find meaning in some of these things. But sometimes I think like if I had to go there now, I would do things a lot differently. I would be super nice to these characters, but I probably wouldn't try and convert them to my religious views just because I don't think that is totally appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think looking back now, having so little understanding of drug addiction, we spent hours and hours and hours with people who were deeply, deeply addicted to terrible narcotics and sometimes would have just ingested large amounts of narcotics right before speaking with us. So they would be like passing out from heroin use while we're in their home, like trying to teach them and just kind of waiting for them to open their eyes back up before we shared the next principle or idea. But just, we didn't know any different or know any better. I didn't know enough about the situation or what was happening. It was just, and at the same time, feeling and being pretty safe for what could have been probably not the healthiest, safest situations. Like, I'm sure, imagining if our parents knew we were in any of the situations that we were in, how they might have felt.
But I think there's a real character that you gain from that, and a real Definitely. Understanding. Like, so many of my coworkers in nursing have never been into someone's house that's just down and out.
Yeah.
And you just don't have an understanding of how people live. And unless you've been in their house, that's just the carpets ripped up and every inch of floor space is covered with cigarette butts. It's amazing.
And the other thing is, I think probably I've been speaking a little cynically and there's a lot of judgment probably that's been seeping into my voice. And I feel badly about that. But at the time, the primary feeling or experience that I feel like I had for these people was one of real love and concern. No matter what was happening, no matter how trashy their apartment was, like what we really felt like deep down was love for this person and wanted to help make their life better. And that was a really beautiful thing, I think, and it really shaped my life.
So Dan, I've had this conversation with Steele before. I want to know if this happens to you. I've had two recurring nightmares in my entire life. One is all of the teeth in my mouth crumble and fall out.
Dude, I've had that happen. I mean, in my dreams. I'm identifying with you.
And the other one is the nightmare that somehow I have to return and go back on my mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've had that one, Dan?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It
You're
was
like, oh, you got to go back out for 12 months or something. You're like, oh, yeah. Man, I already did it.
No, I've had that numerous times. I haven't had it lately. And for most of the dreams where that happened, it was always kind of like, well, you know, Dan, you're not married. and so, you know, we need people to serve missions. So we need you to go back. And it's always one of those. It's like, yeah, I really, really don't want to, but I go and I do it. The awesome part is when you wake up and you realize that's not real life and you're like fist pumping, you know?
Yeah. A lot of times you wake up from dreams and you're sad because what was happening in the dream seemed really cool. But that's the opposite. Like, you wake up from the dream and you're like so glad that's not the reality you woke up to.
Yeah. So, I mean, just going off of what Steele was saying earlier about, you know, I was telling somebody this the other day, how for me, like, putting the mission into, you know, like, if somebody were to ask me, like, what does your mission mean to you? It would be so hard for me to put it into words. I think, you know, people are saying things like, you know, best 2 years. One, I don't think that's true. And I don't think it really does it justice to explain it in some type of soundbite like that. But I do feel like for myself personally, it was, what's the word, formative. And I think for reasons that you're just mentioning, Steele, which is that prior to that, I was just going to high school, you know, just being a teenager. And then, you know, in a matter of days brought face to face with, you know, like the reality that is so many people's lives, where that reality is one of poverty, whether that's, you know, actual material poverty or emotional or something like that. And I feel like it really taught me how to care about important things and to care about people more.
Oh, for sure. I was thinking you used the word formative, and I was thinking for myself, the word I would have used would be like, it was utterly transformative. And the reason for me in a different sense is that I think up to that point in my life, I had succeeded at almost everything that I had tried really hard to do. Like, if I worked at something, I succeeded at it. And in part, I was spoiled and I was lucky and I was very privileged. But I went on my mission and I tried as hard as I could and I tried to obey all the rules and I believed and I had faith and I failed. And I failed over and over and over again. And it was really hard because I had this cognitive sense that, like, if I have faith and if I work hard and I do these things, this is what's promised for me. And I want to love and help these people, but I'm failing. I'm not doing it. And it was in some ways really crushing. In some ways it was really hard. And in other ways it was super important because it taught me a lot, I think, about powerlessness. Like, there are things that we wish were different and we want to be different, and they're not mm-hmm. that way, and we can't make them that way. It's not within our power. And it taught me about my limits in a way that I had not learned before, and that hurt really bad, but it was super important for me to learn. Probably the most important lesson I had in the first 25 years of my life.
Yeah.
And I think that facing those kind of things, those kind of questions, interacting with people in that way, I think it was really formative. I think it prepared me to face, challenges that I'd have afterwards. it's part of one of the aspects of our religion is we feel that trial can strengthen you. And I think that's true in any area of life, not just religious life, but going through hard things makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. And going on a mission to England, that was really hard.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to wrap up the mission stuff, if that's okay, guys, with a couple of short response questions. I'm going to ask a couple quick, rapid questions, and you give me like a 30-second or less answer. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
What meal did you have most often?
Overcooked vegetables, some type of meat, 3 different kinds of potatoes, all in like 1/2 inch of gravy.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it was... Mine was Yorkshire pudding, but it wasn't gravy because I was vegetarian. And then it would be like boiled veg. And that if you're lucky, they'd have salt on the table. It'd be like Brussels sprouts and carrots and mushy peas. All right.
And
okay.
There was never any water on the table. I'm like trying to chomp down like just this 1 pound of dry potatoes. And like my 1/2 ounce glass of water is empty immediately.
But hey, if it was Sunday, they'd have some butter on the potatoes. So you knew it was a special day. Okay, best find in a charity shop. And charity shop's like a thrift store if you haven't been to England.
Oh, man. I still have probably upwards of 50 ties in my closet. And they're all from like charity shops or for free in England. Nice. And I don't need any more ties in my life. They're really handsome.
Mine was my Sydney climbing t-shirt, which was all a good conversation starter at school afterwards. But I never really did climb the Sydney Bridge. I just found it in a charity shop and not.
Say that again, Dan. It was cutting out. It was a what?
It was a Sydney Bridge climb, like Sydney, Australia. Sydney Bridge climb t-shirt.
Nice. So it was a fake accomplishment that you found at a thrift store.
Basically.
That's great. I found a Dixie's Midnight Runners, the 2RA album on vinyl, and I bought it, and it was a great, great purchase. And I think that'll prove important later in the episode. Okay.
Nice.
The most terrifying mission area you served in?
Chelmsleywood.
Is that the place you got robbed at knife point?
No, that was Wellingboro, but it was but Chelmsleywood was much worse.
That's a positive endorsement. All right. Dave?
When I served in Birmingham, then the city, and I was just oblivious to the fact that there were terrible things happening all around where we were walking, until one day I was with a different missionary and he's like, hey, a drug deal just happened there. I'm like, no, it didn't, but it did.
Wow. Okay. Did either of you get your driver's license in England?
No, but I managed to somehow drive the second half of my mission anyways.
Wow.
Do you have any awesome driving stories, Daniel?
Not really, other than the first time that I drove in England was also the first time that I was learning to drive stick shift. So you can imagine how awesome that was, learning to drive stick shift on the opposite side of the road, dealing with roundabouts and things like that. But I will say that driving in England is awesome. It's the best place that I've ever driven ever. People are much better drivers. The roads are super windy and everybody like drives fast, so it's just fun.
I never got my license. I failed the driving test.
You failed the driving test?
I did.
I never tried. I drove just a little bit. My favorite driving story is one area we had a car, and you know, we're like 20-year-old boys with like a crappy European car. And every time we had to drive somewhere for like a meeting with other missionaries, there was a specific way we could go where there was just this wicked jump in the road. So every time my companion's driving, I'm just like, see if you can do it at 70 kilometers an hour this time. And we just trashed that car. Like, it didn't occur to us. Like, this is not a good thing to do.
Yeah, they weren't robust cars. You know, the scariest driving story I had was, we were driving with an English missionary, so he's like, I'm an experienced driver, I know what I'm doing. We're going down the motorway, and we're going to a big, like, mission conference. And it's a two-lane carriageway, you know, so we're in the rightmost lane, which is the passing lane. We're going pretty fast, passing cars. And then after a little while, all of a sudden, traffic's pretty big on our left. There's no space in the lane. We see a semi-truck coming at us in our lane, and it's getting closer and closer, and we realize, oh no, this is going to hit us and kill us. And there's no space to our left. There's no cars coming. And the missionary who trained me, this is like 9 months later, he's about the end of his mission. He yells out, oh shit. And somehow we get back in the left lane, and there's like a space between a lorry and a truck, and we squeeze back in it, and this car clips our what's it called, the rearview, the mirror on the side, the what's the mirror called,
side mirror,
yeah, the yeah. Side mirror explodes. It gets knocked off the car, it's gone, and we're just driving full, like, regular speed. We make it down the traffic, and it's like stunned silence for 10 seconds, and then the driver of the car goes, he says something like, oh, I guess it wasn't a two-lane carriageway. Like, total English understatement. And then everybody turns around and looks at the missionary who sweared and somebody said, oh shit, eh? And then that was it. That's like all that the English people said the whole time about this accident. It was crazy. I saw firsthand the power of, like, understatement and total repression of death. It was very powerful.
I don't think you can serve a mission in a car without, like, almost dying.
Right.
You just can't give 20-year-olds a car to drive around and not expect really dangerous things to happen.
Yeah. So that was my own driving story. So we've spent plenty of time talking about England, talking about missions. If you could go back and do one thing, not go back in time, but you could go back to your mission areas and do one thing, what would it be?
Me and Jenna John used to joke that we'd go back and beat up some English kids.
Were you joking, Dan, or was that like a real wish?
At the time, I was not joking. I would like to think that I've, you know, gotten wiser as I've grown a little older. And I would not do that now. But who knows? You know, I could go over there and someone could say something to me, and you know, could all come flooding back and I just fly off the handle.
But, a kid like you set my tie on fire once.
yeah. I don't know, man. I guess now that Wales is in the mission that Dave and I served in, I'd like to go back and go to Wales. But mostly, I kind of want to go back to England, and nothing against, like, you know, Birmingham or the mission that I served in, but I don't really have much of a desire to go anywhere in my mission. I'd rather just see London and, like, you know, Wales and, you know, like, the Lakes District. I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of agree with Dan. If I went to England again, I probably wouldn't go anywhere in my mission unless it was just traveling through.
Okay, so for me, what I would want to do would be go to the Northeast and visit, like, the cathedrals and the universities and remind myself, like, wait, there are these wonderful, like, institutions of culture and of learning and of sophistication. And just because I spent all my time on council estates with really unhappy people, there's more to that area. I would remind myself, hey, now I can appreciate these things and see them. And I think try to counterbalance the perspective that I had from the narrow range of experiences I had.
But I still love English humor. English TV shows, I think, are hilarious. And it was a good I don't know if I can say it was a good experience. It was an important experience for me to have. I'm glad it was done. I'm glad I did my mission there.
I was going to say I agree, but I don't, so I couldn't honestly say that.
All right. Well, Daniel, you ready? You ready for some questions?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So this is a segment we call Expert Testimony. And Jenna, right. You are our expert, and we want your testimony. So we want to know a lot about some of the topics that you are one of the world's greatest experts on. And I think first and foremost, it's weightlifting. Most people who meet you recognize instantly that you're really jacked, you know, and you take care of your body. Torso, upper body, I mean, rippling biceps. And the first question, I guess, for our amateur listeners are, what's the biggest mistake that people who are new to lifting make that you would counsel people to avoid?
I'm trying to think back to when I was new to lifting.
When you're 11.
It's hard to think back that far, yeah.
So putting myself in those shoes, I would say, you know, everyone's going to say something like, you know, not learning proper technique. But the thing is, that's totally true. I think it pays to, you know, really figure out what proper technique is. And then, really try to execute your lifts accordingly. Otherwise, you'll stand a greater chance of getting injured and you won't be able to lift anymore. You'll be a puny weak guy. The other thing, though, that I would say, and I definitely fell into this camp when I first started, was just focusing on what they call beach muscle lifts, right?
The vanity muscles.
Vanity muscles, yeah. Mm-hmm. If I could go back and tell my, you know, 20-something year old self what to do in the gym, I would have done a lot more squats and deadlifts and lifts like that, as opposed to doing bicep curls and skull crushers and crap like that, you know?
Yeah, you want to actually strengthen your raw power, not just how you look.
Yep, exactly.
Weight room fashion, Dan. What do you like to wear in the weight room?
Shorts, t-shirt, socks, and shoes.
Complicated guy, Dan.
I don't know, man.
And are you looking in the mirror while you're in there?
Sometimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You gotta maintain your technique. Make sure you're keeping all the points in order, right?
And I mean, it's kind of hard not to in most gyms. The gym that we go to, there's just mirrors everywhere.
So the stated purpose for the mirror is to maintain technique. Do you think that's the actual purpose for these mirrors?
No, probably not. You know, everybody's just trying to look at how jacked they are and all that. I don't know.
All right, Dan, this is a crucial question. Everybody wants to know. We've had hundreds of letters about this. They say, okay, Dan Jenajohn, you're king of the weight room for a day. I mean, this is, you're king of the weight room every day, obviously. But let's say you're king of the weight room for a day and they put you in charge of the jukebox. First three songs that you play to just get everybody off, blasted, off to the right start.
That's a really good question.
Thanks.
So Cowboys from Hell by Pantera.
Number one, started off right. Okay.
Then probably Spoon Man by Soundgarden.
Yeah, one for the ladies. That's a good one.
And then Thunderkiss 65 by White Zombie or Nice Shot by Filter.
Ooh, Filter, nice shot. Man, I have a feeling, Dan, people at your gym are going to come out a little more jacked, feeling a little stronger than when they went in.
You're probably right.
Man, you just made my next running playlist. It's done.
Yeah, you're going to break like a 3-minute mile, Dave.
Yeah, I'll run 3 miles in the time it takes to get through those three songs. No problem. Yeah.
Those three songs are basically like steroids.
Next item on the list, Dave, I think you had a question relative to hair care.
So when is it appropriate for a man to use a blow dryer, Dan?
That's a good question. You know, it's probably never appropriate. And in full disclosure to the listeners out there, I did use a hair dryer to blow dry my hair for probably at least 18 months of my life, maybe 2 years.
Those are called the lost years, huh?
Yeah. And
the best 2 years, I think they were called.
That's why he had some hesitance about calling the mission the best 2 years, because it was he's like, I had blow drying years in there, so it's hard to keep.
Yeah. No, you know, honestly, I saw that on the write up that you guys had, and it was like, oh yeah, I used to blow dry my hair, and I really can't remember like the reason why. I'm sure it was because I thought it helped my hair stay in place or something like that, but entirely unnecessary.
So let's move from unnecessary energy usage to something that, yes, that I think you're interested in.
Segway King.
We've done a lot of shows, Steelman. I'm good at this now. But let's move from that to renewable energy, Dan.
Okay.
So what got you interested in this?
I think, kind of like we were talking about earlier with the mission. And I don't know if it happened because of the mission or if it was there prior to the mission, but I always wanted to have a career doing something that I thought was helpful and that was impactful. And so when I was going to undergrad, I found that whenever I would see news about some type of alternative energy form, I was always reading it because I was always just interested in it. And then when I was in DC doing an internship, I went to this panel discussion at the Reagan International Center, and it was put on by Friends of the Earth Middle East, and it was a panel of two Israeli mayors, a Palestinian mayor, and a Jordanian mayor, and they were there to talk about how water crises in their region were adversely impacting all of them, and basically how they were coming together as communities of different people to try and solve an environmental problem. And I saw a couple of things. One, it just kind of reinforced that resource issues were interesting to me. But then also I saw that there was a lot of power in them. Yeah, one, sure. I mean, there's power in them, I think, to divide people. But in this case, it was interesting. It was actually bringing people who had typically at odds with each other, bringing them together to try to solve this problem that was, you know, that really didn't have any considerations for their differences.
So what forms of renewable energy are you interested in? What do you think is cool that's happening now?
Solar is cool, but solar's kind of been happening for a few years now. It's not entirely new, but I think it's the innovation in policy and also business models, you know, that are helping solar come to market and giving solar power access to more people. I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. As an example, there's a business model called community solar. And basically what that enables people to do is that, let's say that you didn't want to have a solar panel on the roof of your house, or, you know, you didn't have a house where a solar panel made sense. You could actually invest in a solar farm, basically within that's in the same county that you currently live in, and so then you would, it's kind of a simplification of it, but because of your investment in it, your utility company would credit your utility bill, right? So you're essentially paying less because you own a portion of this solar farm that produces electricity for the entire grid.
Cool.
And so it's things like that. I mean, there's a lot of different technologies that I think are interesting, but it's what people are doing in terms of financing, business models, and also policy that are actually implementing these technologies into the infrastructure that we use every day. That's what's interesting to me.
So Dan, can I ask you a question? So you're looking at energy policy and financing energy models. Are you looking at the consumer market? Are you looking at corporate investment structures? What's your relationship in your profession to the energy business?
So my official title is a relationship manager for a bank for Wells Fargo. I work in commercial banking, and so essentially what your traditional commercial banker does is they underwrite credit to companies. Like if a company needs a loan to finance their operations, that's one thing that we'll do. But through my group, we only work with clean tech companies, and so clean tech companies face unique obstacles and risk to their business that we understand better than your traditional commercial banking group. And then also I think part of our task is that I see my role as one of kind of internal education within the bank itself, because a company will have a financial need that you know, could need somebody within the bank who has an expertise completely different from my own. You know, like if you know, there could be a company that, you know, wants to do some equipment financing for some electric vehicles that they want to sell to a municipality. And so that's done in a completely different group within the bank. But my job is to help get that group comfortable with the technology, to help them understand that, hey, this technology it's not as risky as we thought it was. And yes, there are these risks, but we can get comfortable with them because of reasons X, Y, and Z. And and so that's essentially what I do. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that does, Dan. And I my follow-up question would be, so is your role in the company, do you feel like it is purely like analysis of financial fundamentals, or do you feel like there's some advocacy for green tech stuff that you think is like important for social reasons too?
I would say both. Probably weighted a little bit more towards the first part. There's actually a group within Wells Fargo that their job is essentially it's like a advocacy group internally within the bank. And then they also have some external functions where they're providing grants to research institutions that, you know, could be looking at developing a better battery storage technology, for example. But saying that, we work closely with that group, right? And we work closely with the companies that they work with. And we're all kind of on the same team. And even though my job might be a little bit more weighted towards, you know, assessing, you know, a clean tech company's financial health to see if we can underwrite credit to them, I mean, everybody in our group, or I would say most everybody is you know, to one extent or another, you know, mission oriented. And I think we all kind of feel that, you know, there's this mission that we have to, of course, our job is to, as bankers, it's to, you know, protect the bank's money and make money for the bank. But if that was the only aspect of my job, I would not do it. I would go find something else to do, because for me, and I think for most of my coworkers, there is that kind of mission aspect of it, of wanting to make a positive impact in terms of the environment and reducing carbon footprint and everything that goes with that.
So Dan, where do you think energy is headed as we move forward? Where would you like to see it go?
I think it's headed towards a little bit more of a consumer centric model, which is where up until now, and quite frankly, this is how most of us still think about it. You wouldn't think twice about the energy that you use, right? It's something where, you know, you pay your utility bill every month, and you use your electricity to light your home, heat your home, etc. And that's all provided by a single company, and that's your utility company. But now I think we're seeing people have more. So basically you have these other companies like solar companies, which are coming along and giving people options.
Yeah.
And that's a very powerful thing. I think it's only part of the actual puzzle though, when it comes to solving not only climate change, but resource issues in general, right? That, I think more optionality for customers is a good thing in terms of producing better energy. And by better energy, I would say cleaner energy, not only in terms of environmental impacts, but also health impacts. And so with that optionality, I would want to see people being better educated about it. And then I think the other sort of elephant in the room that people haven't really talked about yet is basically the consumption side of things, right? Which is that
the blow dryers, the unnecessary blow drying.
The unnecessary blow drying, exactly. You know, no, but I mean, totally true. That I think in our society, we probably consume more than we need to. I myself am very much guilty of that, and I don't know exactly what the solution to that looks like. But I think that's a conversation that needs to be had.
So this is a question I had for you, Dan, because I feel like a lot of the stuff that you're describing is really interesting, but a lot of it's over my head because my daily life is very uninvolved with assessing the financial health of large energy companies, much less green tech or green energy companies. But I do feel like my life is absolutely involved with like the gasoline grid and energy consumption. And I know as an energy consumer, like the biggest decision that I make, the biggest environmental impact decision, it has to do with like the car that I drive or how much I, how I provide my transportation. But what would you say for us as consumers, like if we want to think more carefully and make better decisions about our environmental impact, what would you recommend that we look at or focus on?
Good question. I would say, see, and here is where it gets to be a little bit, I don't know what the word is other than like, I mean, it's kind of like sort of like hard conversation, right? Or maybe it is for some people, but I mean,
that's
think
what this podcast is about, Dan, hard conversations.
All right. The, I mean, I think transportation is a big one, right? How many cars do you own? Do you need all of them? Can you live somewhere where there's public transportation? I would say the other thing from what I've seen, and I'm by no means an expert on all of the people, engineers, scientists who are, you know, could speak to this far more.
I mean, we got Dave on the show. He'll sweep up the loose ends.
Yeah. I would say too, though.
I'm a doctor of nursing, Dan, so covers a lot.
I know it, Dave. Yeah. I would say the other thing though is the food we eat. You know what I mean? I mean, and Steele, I know you know this as a vegetarian. I mean, I love beef. I'll be honest, like it tastes really good to me, but the amount of water that goes into producing like a pound of beef versus a pound of vegetables, is vastly different. And, I think it's looking at things like that, that I think we're going to have to do it at some point, you know?
Wow. So heavy stuff. Let's do it now while we still have some optionality rather than when we're forced to, I think is the big takeaway for me on one of those things. Can we switch the gears a little bit, Dan? And I want to say, we were at your wedding recently, and one thing I was struck by were how many of the memories and the stories that people told about you were you talking about fantasizing punching people in the face. When's the last time you punched another human being in the head?
Summer of 2014.
Wow. Are you feeling a little withdrawal?
No. Well, maybe once in a while. It's I do kind of miss it sometimes actually. The until you go in and you like lace up some gloves with some dude and he just dominates you, just crushes you. I mean, then you're kind of like, oh, okay, I could go out with it. I could go without one of those for a little while, but,
So you've given up bare knuckle. That's the first thing. That's the first sign of weakness. I thought you were fighting bare knuckle still.
No. But the I do miss it sometimes. I mean, it's not something that I did all the time at all. Again, like I feel like for your listeners, the people who don't know me are going to think I'm like some, I don't know, but I'm not. I've never had a real professional fight. I've only trained in gyms, but yeah, it was fun. I don't know. I can't even remember what the question is now, actually.
Last time you hit somebody in the head with your fist.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. Yep. Summer 2014.
We all remember that summer.
I actually, that same summer. So I was training at this, it was this MMA gym down in Santa Monica. And that was the first and the only time, actually, that some dude, he kicked me in the face. Yeah. It's just, we were sparring in the gym and apparently I was throwing punches, but every time that I would, I was letting my hands down, and he saw that. So after I threw like just a combination, it came out like out of nowhere. Didn't even see it coming. Kicked me right in the face, and my jaw was sore for like 5 days.
So some people would probably think like punching another person for fun or for training is kind of stupid, but what would you say in defense? What did you get from doing that sort of thing?
You know, it's a hard question to answer, especially like part of me feels like trying to defend that to someone. I feel like it's impossible.
What's the first rule of Fight Club, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, no, it's what did I get out of it? Like, here's the thing. I'm going to say these things and like, you guys are going to think they sound ridiculous. But the first time that I joined a boxing gym, honestly, I think it was about like one kind of sort of about proving to myself, you know, like what I could do and what I could handle and what I couldn't. But a lot of it was about like respect, basically. I really felt like it was a vehicle for some reason to have more respect for my own self. I don't know if it's because I was like proving something to myself, but then also I also found that like a lot of other people respected me for it, mostly the people that I was that I was actually training with.
You know, Dan, I don't have the same experience with boxing. I had very short arms, and so I would never have been a very good boxer, but I did wrestle for a year, and it was the hardest sport by far that I've ever done. And it was that intense physical challenge where it's you against another person. There's nobody else to blame if you fail, and there's nobody else to credit if you succeed. And you're just – you're physically matched in a draining, exhausting contest of strength and intelligence. And it was exhilarating and super difficult. And it was – I think wrestlers had incredible mutual respect for other wrestlers because they knew what it – how difficult it was and how draining and how lonely and how isolating all that stuff was. And I don't know what – but it sounds similar to what you're describing with boxing.
I mean, I was an intern in DC when I joined my first boxing gym, and like, you know, you feel like
a lot of repressed anger, huh?
I don't know, but I mean, everybody in DC jokes, you know, interns are second class citizens, blah 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 blah.
They weren't even citizens when I was in DC.
Yeah. And
chattel.
But then it's like you spend your day working in this big city where there's these really powerful people, and you're kind of like a nobody, right? But then you like go to the boxing gym, and again, it sounds totally cheesy, but it's like in there, like you become somebody. And especially when you're fighting somebody else, like everybody stops to watch you, and like this other guy, like he has to pay attention to you, right? Like you are the most important person in his life at that point, because if you're not, then you know you're going to beat him or he's going to beat you.
So what you're saying, Dan, is punching somebody in the head was the only way to get them to notice you?
I guess it kind of sounds like that. See, I mean, again, I'm that's teasing. The thing. Like, no. But I mean, it's totally true. There's like, I kind of have this sort of like these conflicted feelings about my passion for fighting and martial arts, because it's, I feel like it's this like fine line where I love it and I know why I love it, and I think it's a respectable sport on a lot of levels, but then at the same time it's violence, basically, right? I think for me it's kind of recognizing that maybe there's a time and a place for it in one's own life. You know, maybe that time is past for me now, but I don't know.
It's interesting. I really enjoy watching UFC. I think it's a valid sport. I think it's really interesting. I think a lot of the discipline that it comes with it, the pushing your body to the limit. It's really interesting, and I think it teaches a lot of good lessons. But one real interesting thing was my favorite UFC fighter for a long time was John Bones Jones.
John Jones.
In all his interviews, he just seemed like a really nice guy. But then it comes out that he was doing cocaine before the matches, and he was recently banned from UFC for a while because he did a hit and run with his car. I think it goes back to that weird balance. Like, there's really positive things that can come from it, but then there's a lot of weird violence and aggression issues that can come from it too.
Yeah. No, they said, I can't remember where I read this, but some fight writer said something about fighters, saying that they either have something that nobody else has, that sort of special X factor, or like they're missing somebody that normal people have, or they're missing something that normal people have. And it's hard to really sort of identify what it is. Maybe, I mean, that could be true or not true. John Bones Jones, though, that guy, and that's the crazy thing about him. He's doing coke before his fights, but he's like the best fighter out there. You know what I mean?
And it's just interesting. Well, it's also an interesting topic of fandom. Like, I really liked him because he seemed like an okay guy, but I really liked him because he was an awesome fighter. That's why I really, that's why he was my favorite, because he's so, and when he comes back and fights again, I'm going to watch it, like, certainly.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, last question, I guess, last topic. I know there's so much more to cover with your expertise here, Dan, but a big part of your life that I remember from college was your interest in the Arabic language and Middle Eastern culture. I remember you spent a year in Egypt.
Yeah.
And so, both of us are big food lovers, and a lot of our listeners are really interested in food. If you had to give us your recommendations for the top Egyptian or Middle Eastern food, what would you advise people to try?
So Egyptian food, and also just to clarify, I was only in Egypt for 1 year. I mean, sorry, 1 year. I was only in Egypt for 4 months.
Okay.
Anyways, Egypt isn't really known for good food. It's kind of like the England of the Middle East that way. But they do have this one dish called koshari. Koshari is basically like, it's like rice mixed with lentils, mixed with fried onions, like a tomato sauce, and sort of like with a garlic lemon juice poured on it. And that stuff was really good. The other thing,
and it sounds
that
vegetarian,
I would say,
too. Is that vegetarian?
It is, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, man. Yeah, one of the few vegetarian dishes you'll get in the Middle East. No, that's not true. They just eat a lot of meat with every meal. Then there's I had this Lebanese dish once, and I did not know the name of it, but it was basically beef in like a tahini gravy with potatoes and onions. I can't remember the name of it, but I don't know. I'm sure somebody out there could Google it, find something like that. It was amazing, super super good. And then the third thing I would say that everybody has to get whenever they're in the Middle East is baklava.
Yeah,
it's so much better there than it is here.
Those are great answers, Dan. The last question that I think we needed to ask, we've had probably hundreds of listeners write in on this one. This is the most listener demand we've ever had people ask, and they said, "We know that Dan Janajan is a real connoisseur of weather women presenters on television."
Jeez.
And they felt which nationality really produced the best talent, on-air talent, for announcing the weather.
Oh, man. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Okay. I don't know what he's talking about either, Dan, but what's your answer? Let's hear.
The story comes from when I was studying Arabic, and to teach us, they had us watch some news channel from Lebanon, and it was the weather woman came on, and the weather woman was this really beautiful Lebanese woman, and literally all the guys in the class, like, she came on, and like it was almost like audible gasp or something like that. It was like
you guys, this woman was
basically. But yeah, and so that happened, and then the professor turned it off, and he said something to the extent of, you know, actually, Lebanon is known throughout the Middle East for having the most beautiful women.
There's the answer.
There you go. Thank you, Lebanon. Well, and Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, and thank you, Dan. Thanks for your expertise. I think we covered at least some of the subjects that you're very knowledgeable in, and hopefully we'll be able to ask you some more someday.
Yeah, I'd be down anytime.
All right, so we always wrap up our episodes with the segment of Unchained Melodies, where we play music that is off the chain. And since we spent so much of the episode this week talking about England and our missions, we're calling this segment British Invasion. We're going to play some of the best songs from England.
Before we go there, I want to ask you guys a related question. So it's a simple question. Are you guys Beatles fans or Stones fans? I feel like there's two different people in the world. Beatles fans, Stones fans.
How about this, Dan? You guess for each of us which one you think is true.
I think you guys are both Beatles.
I enjoy the Rolling Stones music. I've been to a Rolling Stones concert, but if I had to classify myself, I'm a Beatles guy. That's accurate, Dan.
I had to wrestle with that one a little bit, but you were absolutely right. And I would almost guarantee you're a Stones fan.
That's right. I love the Beatles. You know, recognize they're the best band ever. But if I had to pick, you know, which band I had to put on my playlist, one over the other, I'd probably pick the Stones.
Well, let's start us off, Dan. You got a Stone song you want to play for us to start this British invasion?
I think I asked for Under My Thumb.
Okay, here we are. This is the Rolling Stones' Under My Thumb.
I love the Stones. It's so good to sing along with them. Dan, when I worked at Anasazi with the teenage at-risk kids, I'd wake them up in the morning by singing "Time Is on My Side" just really loudly, and it made everybody mad, but it was awesome.
Nice. Yeah, the Stones are one of those bands where I love their songs, but I think almost like most of their songs, 80% of them, they don't really have a good message. You know what I mean? I mean, like the song we just heard, like when you actually listen to it, he's talking about, like, you know, dominating this girl, basically.
Yeah. It's pretty abusive.
Yeah. But,
man, he makes you tap your feet.
it really does.
Yeah. Like, my favorite Stone song might be "Sympathy for the Devil," which is probably like the, and that's the song that they were playing when the Hell's Angels stabbed the guy, and, you know, like,
yep.
And so, like, it's got some baggage, but man, I think it's a great song.
Mm-hmm. Man, we could do a segment of songs to stab someone by, and I think the Stones would be at least 50% of the songs.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Dave, what do you got for us?
Well, Steele, I picked some from the West Midlands, from Birmingham, England.
I'm so
the mission
excited.
Where me and Dan served our mission. And there was a number of hit records, awesome bands from there. You got Black Sabbath, that's where Ozzy Osbourne's from. Fine Young Cannibals with the classic "She Drives Me Crazy." You got the Moody Blues. They're from there.
Are they really? Thought,
yeah.
I grew up with the Moody Blues, Dave.
Who didn't? They're magicians with guitars.
How did that even happen? So I hear about Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath coming out of Birmingham. Like, that makes sense to me. Like, the Moody Blues and Knights in White Satin out of Birmingham. Like, what happened to those guys?
Imposters. Imposters.
Yeah. Were they, like, secluded from everything? I don't know.
They were definitely the kids that Black Sabbath beat up in high school. And they were like, let's go write some jazzy tunes.
some really bad jazzy tunes.
Yeah, I remember it was probably 5 years ago, I realized Knights in White Satin wasn't Knights with a K. And
what?
It made it, like, way worse, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize that till just now. And that ruined that song for me. I was imagining, like, King Arthur, like, pillow talk kind of thing.
But the one that I want to play for you right now is Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Yes.
They're from Birmingham, and their one hit, which is one of the greatest songs ever made from Birmingham, "Come on, Eileen."
Thank you.
Dave, do you understand any of the lyrics to that song except for Come On Eileen?
I don't think anybody does.
Okay. I was hoping it wasn't just me, but I love that song.
And just the thought of them wearing their overalls dancing down the streets of Birmingham, it brings joy to my heart.
You know, that was one of the happiest days of my mission when I was at a charity shop and I found that record on vinyl and I bought it. I was like, I was so excited. And I didn't realize this until I played it after my mission, but they covered the Van Morrison song. Jackie Wilson said, "I'm in heaven when you smile" on that record, and it's quite good.
So, all right, good deep, rock history still.
Deep cuts. All right, gentlemen, this song is for you. This is for both of you. This is from the Northeast, from my mission. This is from Sheffield, the pride of Sheffield, Joe Cocker. And the song is "With a Little Help from My Friends."
To sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do I? All I need is my brother. I say I'm gonna get high.
I think you asked the wrong question earlier on, Dan. You said, are we Stones fans or Beatles fans? When in reality, we're just Joe Cocker fans.
I had no idea that guy was English. I've heard that song hundreds of times. I had no idea.
Dave, he was great voice, Sheffield Soul Shouter. That was his nickname, man.
Oh, I should have known that. Yeah. I'm embarrassed. You've schooled me twice in two songs on rock history.
Yeah, just don't let it happen again. All right, Dan, you got a second song for us?
I picked Trampled Underfoot by Led Zeppelin.
And this band, are they from England? I've not heard of them before.
Indeed, they are. Kidderminster. Kidderminster Steel.
Okay, Kidderminster. Here we go. Led Zeppelin, Trample Underfoot.
Dan, was that in our mission? I just looked up Kidderminster. That's not far outside of Birmingham.
No, that was definitely in our mission. A couple of years ago, I was driving in Los Angeles, and something like this happens to me probably once every 6 months. And I was flipping through radio stations on my car radio, couldn't find anything good on, and so there's some recent top 40s pop song was on, and I was listening to it, kind of like, that's kind of cool. I kind of get into it, and then I changed the station over, and it's Led Zeppelin, Trampled Underfoot, the song we just heard. And it was this moment of like, what was I even thinking? Like thinking that other song was good, right? And it's just like every time I listen to Led Zeppelin, like honestly, like they don't fail to impress and just blow my mind. In like my book, personal book, I would put them ahead of the Beatles. I would put them ahead of the Rolling Stones. I just think they were an amazing band.
I think, and the thing to support that point, Dan, is like Trampled Underfoot is probably not even one of their top 25 best known songs.
Yeah.
And it's still like, that's exactly what Franz Ferdinand stole for that Take Me Home song. That's the guitar riff that they stole. And that became like Franz Ferdinand's greatest song of their career was like Led Zeppelin's 50 best known song or something like that. You know, that's incredible.
Oh, man. Yeah. In the 90s, I was just a young man. After I saw the Stones, it may have even been later that year, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant were on a huge tour and I went with my brother and it was awesome.
You came home and you had your first pubic hair?
that wasn't for another decade still.
Okay. All right. Well, I got my inappropriate joke in for the night. So what do you want to play for us next, Dave?
The only thing I can think to say is if you want a song to make yourself grow pubic hairs, it's this one. Judas Priest, also from Birmingham, and maybe the hardest rocking song I've ever heard. And I dedicate this one to Dan Jenajohn, Living After Midnight.
Nice. Hey, this is from the British Steel album, by the way.
You were trying to fade out earlier, but you had a stroke because of how hard they were rocking. You couldn't do it.
I couldn't. You're so right. That was one of the songs where I absolutely wished that the video had been on. The kick drum comes in on the beginning there, and I could just see like Dan's shirt being torn off, and he's like air drumming. I know that one moved you, Dan.
Definitely.
What do you got to bring us home, Steelman? Okay. I mean, what can you play after that?
So the total antithesis to the song, I was going to play. So two other great bands I just need to mention that are from my mission area. One of them is Def Leppard. They were from Sheffield. And I really wanted to play Two Steps Behind, but they couldn't get the full version on Spotify, so I'm not going to play it. And then I know, Dave, this guy's a real close to your heart, kind of a life philosopher that's changed your life. Sting, Gordon Sumner's from Newcastle. But I'm going to play a song by a lesser known Newcastle band called Lindisfarne. And the song is called Fog on the Tyne because of the Tyne River. Dan, you were mentioning fog earlier in San Francisco. I wanted to bring this episode full circle. This is called Fog on the Tyne by Lindisfarne.
Sitting in a sleazy snack bar, sucking sickly sausage rolls. Slipping down slowly, slipping down sideways. Think I'll sign off the door. 'Cause the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. Fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. Fog on the Tyne is all mine. Could a copper catch a crooked coffin maker? Could a copper comprehend that a crooked coffin maker's just an undertaker who undertakes to be a friend?
And the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine.
Wow, that's it. Yeah, they're like the new Christy Minstrels of England or something, huh?
They really are. That song's got it all. It had a little cowbell. It had heavy alliteration. It had a chorus that almost sounds like they're using profanity.
Are we just going to edit that out, that entire song out in post-production? Because you can't follow up Living After Midnight with that still. Come on, man.
I know. It's hey, you know, you kid. Let's do this one instead then. This one's called...
No.
I was thinking there's one called Country Life, and it's just all folk a cappella stuff. It would have made you just weep for me, Dan, Jen, and John. You would have leaped through the phone and been like, you know, summer 2014 was the last time I punched somebody in the face, but I'm going to have to update that. Well, gentlemen, this has been a real pleasure. I've loved getting invaded by the British invasion with your taste in music. It was really fine. And thanks for enduring my terrible choices. We always end the episode with book wisdom, and I have a poem today by a librarian from Kingston-upon-Hull. His name was Philip Larkin, and the poem is called The Explosion. On the day of the explosion, shadows pointed toward the pit head. In the sun, the slag heap slept. Down the lane came men in pit boots, coughing oath-edged talk and pipe smoke, shouldering off the freshened silence. One chased after rabbits, lost them, came back with a nest of lark's eggs, showed them, lodged them in the grasses. So they passed in beards and moleskins, fathers, brothers, nicknames, laughter, through the tall gates standing open. At noon there came a tremor. Cows stopped chewing for a second. Sun scarfed as in a heat daze. Heat haze dimmed. The dead go on before us. They are sitting in God's house in comfort. We shall see them face to face. Plain as lettering in the chapels, it was said. And for a second, wives saw men of the explosion. Larger than in life, they managed. Gold as on a coin, or walking somehow from the sun towards them, one showing the eggs unbroken.
Well, thank you again, Steelman. Yeah, Steel, you know that the only time I partake in poetry is essentially when I'm speaking to you on a podcast, but I usually enjoy it.
That was very damning with faint praise. I usually enjoy it, and then nothing about this time.
Awesome. What about you, Dan? You got anything to say?
The mine explosion that killed all those men. Did it move you?
No, it was poetry for me. I think. It's this is probably just not damning with faint praise, but probably just poor praise, Stillman. But it's kind of like artwork, which is that it's either something that I hear and I know that I like it, or I know that it doesn't really speak to me that much. But I like that one.
There we go. Thumb up from Dan and John. I liked that one. You could put that on the movie poster for that poem.
Indeed.
Yeah.
You guys, this has been an amazing 2 hours.
This has gone on for way too long.
But I loved every second of it.
Thanks for coming on, Dan. It's good to talk to you.
No, yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. I've been honored. Seriously.
We can't wait to get out to Pacifica and see how the other half lives.
Yeah, come on out here. You guys, you have a place to stay.
All right. As long as you got room for a family of 7, Dan, I'm in.
Well, yeah, okay, maybe not, but...
There's great campsites.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's the show.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Our freezer has been full of breast milk for like the last 13 months. We're living the dream here.
No, breast milk has magical properties. If you rub breast milk on anything, like positive things are going to happen.
We had a neighbor come over today. Here's some cookies I made. Can I ask a weird favor? You guys have any breast milk I can borrow? And I was like, okay.
Did you ask if she needed any other bodily fluids, that more than willing to donate whatever she needed?